You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, you guys, this is our last one. This is it. I'm going to actually do justice here to the last part of Mark. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but we're in a political season. Have you guys noticed that? Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed that during a political season, people are really focused on what's wrong. And so this is your chance to sound off. I'm curious, just shout it out. What do you guys think is wrong right now? Anybody? Let's hear it. Okay. What else? Give me something.
Love for one another.
Oh, wow. That's deep. Yeah. Inflation, immigration, deep state this, and like free voting that, and just everything you can think of under the sun. For me, if I could campaign on one issue, it would be that motorcycles should have good mufflers. I study in a shed in the backyard, right next to Kenny Road, and motorcycles are from the pit of hell, man. It's just so loud. Anyhow, yeah, lots of things. We're hyper-focused right now on what's wrong. You know, the Bible has a thought about that. You know, what is our biggest problem? And the Bible would say it's something called true moral guilt. Okay, moral, because we make choices and do things that hurt each other. And it's true, it's undeniably true, because you just look at history. There's all the evidence you would ever need that human beings are objectively guilty of wrongdoing, what the Bible calls sin. And then guilt is this notion that we're not just knocking around here like atoms. We live in a world that God made. God does exist, and we are culpable before Him. We will be held accountable by Him because of what the Bible calls true moral guilt, and that this issue, more than anything else, this is the deeper, more profound, persistent, and pervasive problem that screws up everything else that we see. And that this, more than anything else, is what we need help with. That's what the Bible says. And so what we're going to study this whole morning here is God's solution, which is something called the substitutionary death of Christ. I know that sounds like a mouthful, but substitutionary simply meaning that instead of us having to undergo God's judgment for the true moral guilt that we all have, that Jesus has stepped into our place and absorbed God's judgment into Himself as our substitute. The solution to our biggest problem of true moral guilt is the substitutionary death of Christ. And so that's what we're going to get into. Now, I want to get you up to speed. Last week, we talked about Jesus entering Jerusalem on a donkey. He was hailed as the King, the Messiah. And then we also saw how when He rolled into Jerusalem and went to the temple, He started overturning the tables of the money changers, just completely disrupted everything. And not surprisingly, when we get up to chapter 14, now we're getting closer to the Passover, we read that the chief priests and the scribes who were profiting from that market in the temple, they were seeking how to seize Jesus by stealth and kill Him, for they were saying, not during the festival of Passover, otherwise there might be a riot of the people. Okay, so they realize Jesus is incredibly popular with the crowds. If we're going to get Him, it's going to have to be at night, away from the public eye. And so after this, if you read into Mark 14, I think this is the night before the Passover, Jesus has a last supper, a final meal with His disciples. And at this meal, he reveals that one of them is going to betray him. And to a man, including Judas, they all say, oh, no, surely not I. And yet by this time we know, because it's in Mark 14, verse 10 and 11, we know that Judas has already met up with the religious leaders and arranged to turn Jesus over to them at night so that they won't run into problems with the crowds. And so after this dinner, keep reading in Mark 14, they head to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is kind of halfway down the Mount of Olives, at night. And during this stretch, Jesus knows he can feel the heat. He knows that he's got a lot of enemies. And he goes to three of his disciples and tells them, would you please stay awake and keep watch while I go pray? But they didn't stay awake. And so as you get into this part of Mark, Jesus is alone. There's not a person on the planet who's looking after him. And in that kind of vulnerable state, we read that Jesus was praying to the Father. He says, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. The cup, he mentions. Now, a lot of people, they see this cup and they think, well, he's probably thinking about all the physical suffering he's about to endure. That's part of it, no doubt, but it's more than just this physical suffering. This cup, which comes up quite a bit in the Old Testament, is a cup of wrath, God's wrath against human sin. The sin of humanity swirling around in that cup, and the judgment God will pour out on that sin. That's what this cup is. And what's strange about this whole scenario is here's Jesus, a sinless person, who's considering the cup and he's saying, will you take it away from me? Now, why is that? He's not guilty of anything. He's not worthy of judgment. Why would he, of all people, be confronted with the cup of God's wrath? Well, it has to do with the concept of substitution, which I want to talk about all through here. The substitutionary death of Jesus. What is this cup? Well, maybe this is a weird analogy, but bear with me. Maybe this will help. Picture all of humanity embodied as a barfly sitting at the bar, okay? A person sitting at the bar representing all of humanity. And the bartender pours this foaming draft of judgment, puts the mug on the table, and slides it over and says, bottoms up. That, according to the Bible, is the state that humanity is in. That's the bad news of the Bible, that because of our moral culpability, because God is perfect, because God is just, we are the worthy recipients of his judgment. And so that's what the bartender slides across the bar in front of humanity. But then Jesus reaches over and he slides that cup over to him, and he drinks it to the dregs, every last drop, for us. That's what Jesus is contemplating. As he thinks and talks with God about this cup, he's contemplating absorbing all of God's judgment into himself for everything every human being has done wrong for all time. Now, I'm sure most of us can admit, yeah, I've got some issues. I've done some things. And our reflexive thought is, because I've got issues, maybe I could make it up. Maybe I could be more self-disciplined. Maybe I could, you know, turn a new leaf and get it together. Maybe that's the solution to addressing the problem. No, that's not. It will never be the solution. This is the solution. This is our solution. Jesus, alone, agonizing over taking in our judgment as our substitute on our behalf, and then telling the Father, you know, not as I will, but your will be done. That's what he settled in the garden, that he would proceed with God's plan for him to be our substitute. Well, if you keep reading, because the disciples were sleeping, they weren't up on what was happening. And Judas and the religious leaders were able to get up into the garden and ambush Jesus. Judas kisses Jesus to identify him and betray him. And at that point, after they took Jesus into custody, it says that all of his disciples ran away. And then they led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. Okay, so what's about to follow is really two things. We're going to see a couple examples of Jesus being put on trial, and then we're going to see his actual execution. But at this point, if you shift over and focus on the trial section, the first person he comes before is the high priest. And in both of these trials, I just want to call your attention to a few things to look out for. One thing we're going to see is injustice. Jesus will never be treated fairly in any of these trials. He'll totally be denied justice. We're also going to be hopefully struck by Jesus' kind of calm dignity as he faces his abusive accusers. We're also going to see, because he's innocent, the focus inevitably shifts off anything that he's ever done wrong, which is nothing, and onto who he is. It keeps coming back. You're guilty because of who you are. You'll see that again and again in these trials. And we will also see, as we wrap this part up, this topic of substitution. So at the chief priest's house, it says the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they weren't finding any. And you can read, like, they even were bringing forth false witnesses to try to concoct something that was worthy of death that Jesus had done. Of course, there wasn't anything. And these witnesses couldn't even get their stories to match. They at least cared about that. And so, realizing we don't have anything concrete on Jesus that we could bust him for, they shifted their strategy and started to attack him for who he was. The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you not answer? What is it? What is it that these men are testifying against you? What are they trying to say?" But he kept silent and didn't answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him, and here we go. He says, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now, if there was ever an exit ramp, right, this would be an opportunity to turn the burner down a little bit. The Christ, that's the Greek word for the Messiah, the coming King. Jesus could have been like, yeah, people got carried away when I was coming into Jerusalem. Yeah, I know I got a little extra in the temple there, but no. Don't be mistaken. I'm not the Christ. But that's not how this goes down. Jesus replies, "I am. I am the Messiah King. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." This is called doubling down. He's like, you know that passage in Daniel? The one where the Messiah King comes to destroy his enemies and set up his eternal dominion. You know that passage? That's about me, and I'll be coming for you. Okay, so this is pretty muscular response. Obviously, that's all they wanted to hear. The high priest is like ripping his clothes apart. I always wondered, that'd be hard. If I tried to do this, I'd be like, I can't do it. Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death because of who he was. And see, this is they finally got him on something they can execute him for. Now, here's the deal. They spit at him, blindfold him, pound him with their fists. You can tell they would just love to kill him right on the spot, but they can't do it. They do not have the right as subjects of the Roman Empire to execute anybody. The Romans reserved capital punishment for themselves. And so they can mistreat him and slap him and beat him, but they can't kill him. You know, in their law, if he truly is, which he wasn't, guilty of blasphemy, that's the legal means to execute him. But because they can't do it, they've got to take him to Caesar. And by the fact that he claimed to be king, the fact that he is claiming to be a rival king to the Roman Caesar, that's enough to be charged with sedition. And so you can just tell, as soon as they get him to just flat out say, "Yes, I'm the king," that's when they're like, "Well, let's go see the Romans." And so as you keep reading, the second trial that we get to is where the high priest takes Jesus to face Pilate, the governor of Judea. And so you get this whole crowd of religious leaders. They're dragging Jesus with them. And we read, early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate. Okay, now Pilate has dealt with a lot of people. He's conducted a lot of trials, sent a lot of people off to be executed. And so when Pilate sees this guy, he's like, "Are you the king of the Jews?" You can tell that the religious leaders prepped him. They're like, "Hey, we've got this guy. He's saying he's the king of Israel." And Pilate's like, "Seriously? Are you really saying that you're the king?" Again, a nice exit ramp. This would be a great place to kind of step off and just tone things down. But Jesus, very calmly, with a lot of dignity, just like we saw with the high priests, he's like, "Yeah, I am. Just like you said, I am the king of the Jews." Now, if you read this, if you keep reading this account, we will, you can tell that Pilate is gradually getting more and more disturbed. He's crucified a lot of people. We know from just Roman history, Pilate sent a lot of people to the cross. And normally when people are headed that way, they will say or do anything, they'll confess to anything, they'll do whatever it takes to avoid that kind of brutal execution. But that's not what we see here. It's not it at all. You know, the chief priests are like kind of jumping on him and accusing him harshly, but Pilate's, you can tell he's agitated. He's like, "Aren't you going to answer? Do you see how many charges they're bringing against you?" But Jesus made no further answer, and it says that Pilate was amazed. Now, this word amazed has the sense of like admiration. This was different. This kind of calm, collected, you know, somebody with a dignified bearing facing just this riotous group of religious leaders facing the prospect of crucifixion. Pilate was like, "What is it with this guy? You're different." And we know from the other gospels, he was literally losing sleep at night, thinking about this guy, thinking about Jesus' situation. And somewhere in this interaction, maybe it's because he heard about Jesus' miracles. Maybe it's because just in the presence of Jesus, he was so struck by Jesus, the person. He starts working to get Jesus released. And it says at the feast, Pilate would release for them anyone prisoner who they requested. And there was a guy there with Jesus, a guy named Barabbas, who had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists, who had committed murder in the insurrection. Okay, so here's a truly bad guy, an insurrectionist murderer. Okay, that's pretty bad. And Pilate's got that guy, and he's got Jesus with him. And it says the crowd went up and began asking him to do as he'd been accustomed to do for them, which was to release one of these prisoners that the crowd chose. And Pilate answered and said, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" Now he said this because he knew that the chief priests had handed Jesus over because of envy. He knew Jesus was popular with the crowd. So he thought, if I give the crowds the choice to rescue Jesus, they'll do it. And I'll be off the hook. I'm not going to have to feel bad about killing someone that's innocent and that I kind of sense is really important. But we read that the chief priests, like it says here, I don't know if I have that verse. They stirred up the crowd, there it is, yeah, to ask him to release Barabbas instead. So somehow the chief priests are able to lobby the crowd, maybe with a little help from the evil one, I've always wondered. And the crowd is tilted toward asking for Barabbas to be released. And answering again, you know, Pilate's like, "Then what do I do with this guy that you call King of the Jews?" And they shouted back, "Crucify him." But Pilate said, "But what has he done?" The problem is, none of this has ever been about anything Jesus has done. They never answer that question. They just shout all the more, "Crucify him." And wishing to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas for them. And after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. And so, this, just picture this, you know, this dignified man who's being treated unjustly, calmly keeps saying no to all these exit ramps, moving closer to closer and closer to crucifixion. And here, what is this really? We have this guilty, murdering insurrectionist, this rebel who is being pardoned, and then this innocent man being condemned in his place. What is that? Why is this in here? That's substitution. That's a picture of what we're about to see unfold. The innocent will die for the guilty, so that the guilty can go free. And then we get to the execution, and we see the theme of substitution really kick in. We read in that prior verse, Pilate had Jesus scourged. I'm not going to show you like grisly pictures, but they would take a long leather whip that was studded with broken bone fragments and chunks of lead, and they would rip the shreds off of people's back and the back of their legs until they almost bled out. A lot of people would die as they were being scourged, just because that alone was enough to kill somebody. Sadly, with the Romans and with crucifixion, they were just getting started. It says that these soldiers, the Roman soldiers, took him away into the palace, and listen to this. It says they called together the whole Roman cohort. I'd never noticed this before I studied it. 480 soldiers. And the vibe is, "Hey boys, we got a pretty entertaining crucifixion. Why don't you all come on down to the Praetorium?" And they basically have a party. And Jesus is the pinata. I mean, that's basically what happens. They dress him up in purple. And after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews." Now, back then, it was normal for kings to wear something called a corona radiata. It was a crown that would depict the rays of the sun as a symbol of power going up in points. Okay, and so what we're seeing here is they take something pointy like thorns, and in this part of the world, they're about 6 inches long, weave a crown, and then just press it into Jesus' scalp. Now, some commentator, this is kind of an interesting thought, but in the Bible, thorns, all the way back to Genesis 3, are associated with God's curse on mankind. He cursed the ground that they would work after they sinned in the garden. Is it possible that unwittingly these soldiers, by pressing this symbol of God's curse on humanity down on Jesus, once again, we're seeing that the image of substitution, Jesus takes it on himself? It says they kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling and bowing before him. And after they mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put on his own garments, and they led him out to crucify him. Now, it was typical back then that the crucifixion victim would carry not the whole cross, usually a cross beam, all the way up to the execution site. Jesus wasn't strong enough to do that. And so it says that they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, who appears later in the Bible, who apparently people knew because Mark's like, oh, by the way, you know, it's the father of, he's the father of Alexander and Rufus. He's the guy that got brought in to bear Jesus' cross. And then they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. In the ancient world, when they carried out executions like this, they always did it just outside of the city. And so we read, it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, the King of the Jews. Now, just looking at, I know it's hard to look at, I tried to pull the camera back a little bit, but you should understand that crucifixion was designed by the Romans for crowd control. It was meant to humiliate the victim, and it was meant to terrify the populace. This sign, you know, the King of the Jews, what's the message? Ah, you want to be a king? Well, there you are, stapled to a cross, buck naked. Who else wants to be king? You know, that was the whole design of this scenario. But, you know, God had his own design. And this is a hard to look at. But this is the glory of God right here. This is this incredibly powerful king who does not use, a true king, who doesn't use his power to exploit and dominate, but who uses it to lay his life down for you as a substitute. That's what this is. That's what God designed this for. Well, it says, they crucified two robbers with him, one on the right and one on the left. Another thing they would do sometimes to try to humiliate people. It just seems like, you know, it couldn't get any worse. But there's a point in all this. Even this mention of these robbers being crucified with Jesus, we read the scripture was fulfilled in that. The Old Testament predictions were fulfilled, which say he was numbered with the transgressors. Now, the brackets here, those are there because this actually is not part of our earliest manuscripts of Mark. But Jesus, but this is in the account. Luke says the same thing, that the scripture was fulfilled that says that he was numbered with the transgressors. And you're like, well, why is that a significant detail? Well, if you go back and look in Isaiah, in Isaiah 53, it describes the Messiah getting executed. And in the description, which is written 700 years before Jesus lived, it says, my righteous servant will justify many. He'll bear their iniquities. He was poured out in life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. You know, the Romans put the criminals there to humiliate the King of the Jews. But those criminals were there in the plan of God so that his Messiah could identify with sinners like us and bear their sin on their behalf. That's the whole point. That close association with these transgressors, with sinful people like us, it's Jesus's, he's just saying, I'm here to die for you. That's the whole point of this. It's substitution. Well, those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, ha, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross. In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, he saved others. He can't save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we can see and believe. And even those who were crucified with him, the criminals on his right and on his left, were insulting him. Just try to see this through Jesus' eyes. Just think about the last few days. You know, he was praying alone and his disciples fell asleep. One of his disciples betrayed him. Then every disciple abandoned him. Then he was mistreated and beaten by the Jewish leadership and then scourged by the Romans. And then we see, just backing up, right, we've got the passers-by were abusing him. The religious leaders were mocking him. Those who were crucified with him insulted him. Rejection, rejection, rejection. And we think when we're seeing this, we maybe feel removed. Maybe that's some ethnic group that's responsible, whatever. No. What we're seeing is humanity. This is human rebellion. This is all of us. This is the race of man who has rejected God's leadership. We're all part of this. That's the picture. And you know, you look at what a wicked crowd. What a messed up group of, what a race of people. Just wow. So messed up. What's it going to take to save them? Well, coming down from the cross won't help. That's what they're basically taunting him to do. But he can't come down from the cross. He needs to stay right where he's at. Even as they mock him for doing it, he's got to stay right there if he's going to be a substitute. The only option is to just keep letting it unfold and to be a substitute. That's the only way to help people far from him come to him. There's no other alternative. Well, it says the sixth hour came, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. It's like creation itself has rejected Jesus. You know, it's interesting, this darkness, we have sources outside the Bible. There's a guy named Phlegon, a Greek writer, who says during the 202nd Olympiad, which happens to be 33 AD in the Greek calendar, matching to our date. 33 AD, the best date we have for the crucifixion of Jesus. This ancient witness says there was a prolonged darkness during that year that affected, among other places, Palestine. Now we saw, when was the eclipse? Back in April? That was just a minute or two, right? Eclipses do not last for 3 hours. This was not an eclipse. This was the judgment of God poured out on Jesus. That's exactly what this was. If you read in the Old Testament passages like Zephaniah that talk about the day of the Lord when judgment comes, it describes it as a day of darkness and gloom. Nothing less than the judgment of God. That's what this is about. Poured out on Jesus, this 3 hour stretch of just bearing under, drinking that cup. And it's not surprising then at the end of this stretch, at the ninth hour, Jesus cries out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" People read this and they think, oh, he was so confused. He felt betrayed. I could not be further from the truth. These words are a verbatim quote of the very first verse of Psalm 22. Jesus, by saying this, is calling attention to anyone who knows the Old Testament to marvel as they watch exactly what Psalm 22 describes play out before their eyes. Read it for yourself. It's a very detailed description of Jesus' crucifixion. And he's calling attention to that. He's calling attention to that because this was part of God's plan. It's not like Jesus invented a new religion. Long before he lived, this was always part of God's plan to send his son to die in our place. Well, it says that Jesus uttered a loud cry, and as he breathed his last, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, this veil is a super thick curtain that's in the temple. And if you look at the temple from kind of an overhead view, that veil separated worshipers from this special room called the Holy of Holies, where God's presence dwelt. And he's saying that shower curtain, right, that heavy, thick curtain was literally ripped from top to bottom by the hand of God. And not just to do it, it was a symbol that now the way is completely wide open. We can have direct access to Jesus. We think, you know, I got to clean up my act. No, Jesus paved the way by offering his life as a substitute. And now anyone who trusts him in that way can come into the direct presence of God. That's exactly what we're supposed to get. Again, it's substitution. He went in our place. Yeah, and I know we think, man, there's just so many obstacles between me and God. All the stuff I've done in the past, all the things I've thought about Christianity. There are no obstacles according to this. Not a single thing is between you and God, but your own decision to put your trust in Christ as your substitute. That's it. All right, we've done a lot in the book of Mark. We've talked about Jesus quite a bit, and I thought it would be helpful to kind of boil this down as you're weighing out what to do with this information to the essential facts. One, Jesus' trials and execution are a historical fact. This is not an area of dispute. And the reason why? It's because we have ancient witnesses like Tacitus who totally confirm there was a Jesus and he was crucified at the hands of Pilate. All these things we're reading about the trials and execution of Jesus, they're not in dispute. These things happened. The other thing we can actually say is that the Old Testament did undeniably predict that the Messiah would die in our place for our sin. Read Psalm 22 yourself. Go read Isaiah 53, all of it. And you'll see it's absolutely the case that the Messiah in the Old Testament was destined to die in our place for our sin as a substitute. And here's a third thing to keep in mind, is that Jesus chose this. You know, some people are like, well, maybe he was so stubborn, he just didn't want to admit he was wrong. Or maybe he was just ahead of his time and misunderstood and was tragically killed. Now, you've seen all through this, he had multiple exit ramps. He said no to those and calmly carried out his mission, which he laid out crystal clear earlier in the book. This has been all the way through the book of Mark. Jesus has been very aware, the Son of Man, that's his term for himself. I didn't come to be served, but I came to serve and give my life as a ransom. And so those are the facts, these things. Yes, this actually happened. Yes, it was predicted to happen. And yes, the guy who went through with it absolutely voluntarily offered his life as a substitute for you because he loves you. Because as wicked as humanity is, he loves the world and gave his life up to reach us. Okay, so what to do? A couple quick thoughts here. When you hear all this information, it requires a response. It really does. What we've heard requires is this isn't just something to know. What we've covered here is something that requires a response. One response we see, which is incredible, is that the Roman centurion who was standing right in front of him, when he saw the way that Jesus breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." You know, this is crazy. He didn't know any Old Testament. And many of the Jews who did never figured out the significance of this event, but this guy got it. And he concluded, he's the Son of God. And so I ask you, I think this info merits some kind of response. That was his. What about you? You know, one example of a response is Pilate's response. You know, Pilate was so beholden to the opinions of the crowds and his superiors that he really never responded. He actually never did anything. He famously just washed his hands and stepped away from the whole thing. He never took a stand on who Jesus was. But in the end, his unwillingness to decide was a decision. It was a decision to reject Christ. It led to Jesus' crucifixion. I remember years ago, I came out to this church, and I sat in a teaching like this, and I went up to the teacher afterwards, and I was saying, yeah, I'm just kind of weighing it out, I don't know. And maybe he could tell I was being flippant, but he looked at me and he said, Mike, it says that while we were yet enemies, Christ died for us. He was like, don't water down the state you're in. You need to make a decision at some point. This is not just some open-ended question. And I was, and maybe you're, but that's, I think that's one of the lessons that we're supposed to get from Pilate's response, is no response ultimately is a rejection of Christ. And then, I love this guy, Joseph of Arimathea. He shows up out of nowhere. He comes, a prominent member of the council, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, and he gathered up courage, and he went in before Pilate, and he asked for the body of Jesus. It sounds kind of creepy, but he wanted to take Jesus' corpse and put it in a tomb to give him a decent burial. And Pilate agreed. Joseph took his body, and then 3 days later, Jesus rose from the dead. You can read the account at the end of Mark. These women show up and the tomb is empty. And I wonder how Joseph of Arimathea felt on the day that Jesus rose. I mean, I'm sure he was glad to have his empty tomb back. That's a bonus. He'll still get to use it. But to realize, you know, Jesus was still dead when Joseph threw in and said, I'm going to follow this guy publicly. He risked a lot to openly take Jesus' body and put it in his tomb. And he said, I don't care. I've seen enough. He's the Son of God. I'm in with him. And man, was he confirmed in that decision when Jesus rose. And I just would appeal to you. You've heard enough, I think, if you're honest, to be able to go to Jesus and say, if it's really true you're my substitute, I'm in right now. I want to follow you. I want what you did on the cross to apply to me, to deal with my true moral guilt. That would be a great way to respond to this. So, okay. Here you go. Game over. I conquered a gospel. How about that? Ah, oh, Jesus, I've never been loved by anybody the way you've obviously loved all of us. And I just thank you. You have proven beyond doubt that you can be trusted by the payment you made for me. And I just thank you. Yeah. Amen.